Hello, everyone. You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. Thank you for tuning into today's show of Intersections, CITR's biweekly radio show about intersectional feminism, gender empowerment, and bringing down the patriarchy, all of which are in a day's work for the small, powerful team here at CITR. We air every other Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m., so make sure you tune in for some woke conversations and content. So today's show is extra special, so I'd like to kick it off a little differently by reading a few lines of poetry. Here we go. If I could speak, I can. It's a different language. When I walk by the pizza shop on Venice, the family behind the counter wishes me, Khuda Hafiz, as if we have known each other long enough to speak of protection. I call my parents later to say to them, to make them laugh. To remind us, we're alive. Now, for those who don't know, Khuda Hafiz is a Persian parting phrase, translated as may God be your guardian or may God be your protector. Persian because the poet in question, Shazia Hafiz Ramji, has Iranian and Indian heritage. And the poem is actually an excerpt from a longer poem in progress about reconciling Shazia's heritage and diasporas in East Africa, Canada, and the UK, and what it means to feel at home. Shazia Ramji is with us right now, live in the studio. She is many things, a poet, writer, editor, and her first book, Port of Being, received the Robert, and I'm going to butcher this, Robert Croce? Croce Award for Innovative Poetry and was published with Invisible Publishing this October. Shazia, it's no coincidence that you share your middle name with the beautiful 14th century Persian poet, Hafiz. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lakshmi. So nice to be here.
And speaking of coincidences, me and Shazia found out that we have something in common when I asked her to come onto our show, Intersections. Tell us about your writer's group, Shazia.
I also have a group called Intersections. And I befriended Lakshmi just this year, and I found out she also runs a show called Intersections. And I basically invite an author each month to talk about writing and writing life from an intersectional lens. And we have discussions about difficult questions, what it means to be a woman of color in writing, and those sorts of questions that are difficult to bring up in other contexts.
Right. And Shazia, when we spoke before, you talked about how Eurocentric the creative writing field is.
Sorry, did you say how eccentric?
I guess it's eccentric too. Eurocentric.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. Break that down for me. What did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's Eurocentric and white on many levels, especially when we think about, you know, the nationalist project that is Canadian literature. So since the 50s and 60s has always been a canon of writers who have been mostly white. And that sort of trickles down in how we talk about Canadian literature and the values that we embody and the values that we put in our own work and how we discuss what means what is meaningful to us. So I think that that needs to change, and it's slowly changing, but very slowly.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's, by the way, guys, I'm joined in studio also by Carol and Danielle. Say hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
And obviously, you know, all three of us, we're journalists, budding journalists. And I feel like this topic of Eurocentrism and a very, I think, homogenous field is something that we struggle with as well. And I'm sure a lot of you guys heard about the Sunny Dillon case. That was pretty much raging on Twitter. Was it like, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? It's pretty recent.
They're naughty.
Carol's lost her voice.
Sorry.
one of the big things with that situation, for those who don't know about what that was, Sunny basically was covering, Van Poli, and he wanted to write an article where there was a focus on race, and the bureau chief of the Globe thought it wasn't as relevant. Talking about race wasn't relevant, and the bigger question in that article should have been about women, and it should have, but race was just as important. And yeah, he quit, which I think was a pretty powerful move. So, yeah, I mean, what do you guys think about that? You're budding journalists. We're in the same field.
When that happened, I was kind of confused because, no, I guess not confused, but probably more envious of the fact that, like, his position of power and the fact that he had so many years of experience, he was able to speak out on this issue. And it really goes to show how much work we still have to do in terms of intersections and race and gender issues in the Western media and in Canada, a place where we pretend that we are very multicultural, which is often a facade, and it's not true. We're just better at disguising it. And when I read his piece, it really made me think about how even in student journalism groups, I went to U of T, it was very white. And even there, I felt I belonged, but there were situations that made me think, I don't think I can speak about this issue because I'm a woman of color. Mm-hmm. And I don't have as many years of experience as other peers. And so it kind of made me think about, like, would I be able to speak about certain issues if I were in a similar position with lesser years of experience, like Sonny did? Because he's coming in from a position of power, whereas for many of us, we go through this and we want to speak about it, but we don't have that kind of, I guess, social status to mm-hmm. speak about it. So it's mm-hmm. like, well, do we have to wait 10 years and then be like, okay, now I have the position, the social status to speak about it? Or are we supposed to kind of sacrifice our, as you say, budding careers to speak up on an issue that's really important to us?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was gonna say as well. I mean, is quitting your job like all that we can do to kind of prove mm-hmm. how important these conversations are? Danielle, are you gonna say something?
Yeah, and also this is one of the questions posed to Sonny himself that mm-hmm. a lot of people asked him, that you're quitting the Globe, wouldn't that mean that there's one less person of color mm-hmm. in the industry? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. he does then talk about how it is the move itself was that powerful that it got a lot of attention. So is that the kind of things that are necessary to kind of spark these conversations? Do people really need to make these kind of moves to quit or something? Or is this more of a conversation that we really need to have in newsrooms and mm-hmm. other places to mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just talk about this issue?
Yeah, and I mean, talking about speaking up, I think with social media, there's, in some ways, it's, I think, easier to speak up about these conversations about race, or really about just kind of finding your voice as a person who's not really in a position of power in, you know, today's society's hierarchy. It's easier to speak up on Twitter in certain ways, but Shazia, what do you think, that translates into real life? Do you think when push comes to shove, people are just as willing to be, you know, vulnerable and honest about what they really believe in and stand for?
Oh, that's so difficult. And I feel like it gets only more complicated the further we get into it and mm-hmm. the more time passes. Mm-hmm. You know, the obvious examples, positive examples that have come out of this mm-hmm. are, you know, Black Lives Matter, the mm-hmm. movement, and mm-hmm. also the Arab Spring. So there's a lot of potential to, you know, gain solidarity mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. to find allies and to just say, you know, have a space for your voice. But I think that increasingly, especially now in the smaller circles of Canadian news and media and literature, I'm seeing a lot of censorship. You know, writers, I have been a victim of this too, where, you know, like something that I've tweeted has been taken into another context and said, oh, this was, you know, this it was on my Twitter account, but it's turned into a different kind of story. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's, you know, what is the extent of one's, the way someone uses Twitter? How personal is it? How mm-hmm. private is it? It doesn't mm-hmm. mean, is it really private when it is? You know, what is, mm-hmm. and how, you know, it's so difficult, because even Sonny stepping down and talking about it on Twitter, because that's how I found out about it, it's just so sad to me, because I feel like so much weight falls on the person of color to mm-hmm. make those comments, and it's so alienating to speak up and to be the only one who's speaking up often, and to only rely on something like social media to connect you to others who would, mm-hmm. you know, find you.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important point that you brought up, Shazia, about the weight falling on the person, like on a person of color's shoulders, to actually stand up for their own rights. I mean, I often wonder about the line between what is the line between me standing up for myself and sort of, I guess, it seems like I often feel like I'm screaming into the void. Mm-hmm. And it's just me yelling, and there's nobody yelling back or yelling with yeah. me. And I just wonder about allyship. I wonder, yeah, I wonder about allyship. Like, how important is that?
I mean, I think you bring up a good point in that, like, you're saying it almost feels like you're screaming into a void. And I think that's where we need a lot of woke white people who are allies to people of color.
WWP.
Yes, yeah. Because unfortunately, when people of color are speaking out about our hardships and difficulties, it's true, often people don't listen. And it's only when a person who's white chimes into that conversation, then that's when people are like, oh, okay, like maybe we should have a conversation about this. And that's kind of a weird space because people of color have voices. We are our own agents.
No, really? That's weird. Really? This is news to me.
Oh, yikes. Well, like we're autonomous people. But it almost feels like we need a white person to be our voices. And that's kind of where you have to ask, like, well, what makes a person a good ally? And it's something that I feel like I'm still trying to understand and unpack myself with, because I have a lot of friends who are white and they are good allies, but so there's certain situations where I'm like, well, you didn't have to say that. Like, mm-hmm. you could have given me the ground or the floor to speak my truth. So mm-hmm. I guess, Shazia, like, what, in your opinion, is a good ally?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And there's so many, you know, intersectional dynamics there where, you know, automatically the white person is a person in power. So we go to them to raise our voice. And sometimes our voices get appropriated or taken out of context when that happens too. But allyship is so difficult now too, especially in an institutional context where it's taken, it becomes a label almost. You know, there's mm-hmm. I've been in situations or rooms where people have worn ally tags, you know, to say that they're allies. And mm-hmm. I feel like it's really weird when it's a label or an identity. It has to be something that's always in progress and something that's constantly becoming. And to do that, I think that relationships have to be built with people just constantly. We have to talk about it. I mean, allyship's happening right here, if I can say so.
Hey, we're making change right here at CITR.
Baby steps, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what is, I mean, you talked about having some of your friends have just said stuff that you were like, ah, it's kind of weird. So is that, like, what would a bad ally look like?
Well, I don't want to call my friends bad allies, but around Halloween, mm-hmm. you know, cultural appropriation is a big topic. And one of my, I guess, woke-er girlfriends, she asked me, like, well, what's really wrong with someone doing blackface? And it was just, like, a very, like, she was genuinely curious because, like, she couldn't empathize with people who were so frustrated with white people doing blackface, so I was like, well, historically, there's that kind of legacy of just everything and just wrong. But also, we'll, like, try to put yourselves in our shoes. Like, your culture is being taken in out of context, and it's being used as a prop for fun. And maybe I wasn't articulating it correctly, but she just still didn't understand it. And so in that kind of space, we were at a party, and I met a dude dressed up.
Whoa. This is PG rated, Carol.
Don't worry. As a geisha, mm-hmm. which, you know, was interesting because it was a dude. But I was so flabbergasted that he was doing that, and he was white. And my friend just kind of looked at me and was like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine, but I'm quite shocked and I really don't know what to make of the situation. She was like, well, it's a joke, like, he's not meaning it to be offensive. And I was like, well, perhaps his intentions were not to do mm-hmm. so, but the fact that he did that, and, like, I'm being very shocked by it, and I guess the word triggered, even though that word is very problematic, like, I found offense to it. And she was like, well, yeah, well, not every person who is Asian is going to find offense. And I'm like, yes, that's true. But that's a personal attack on me because I've seen so many people, they wear Asian-like costumes, and there's this whole issue of just yellow fever in general. White men are just so obsessed, and it's disgusting. And so I had to leave that party, and she stayed. And so for me, that moment where I was like, okay, you are not the greatest ally for me as a friend and just as a person who is constantly preaching about how white people need to support and empower people of color. Mm-hmm. So that was a moment where I was like, okay, girl, bye.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you say that, because I've usually heard allyship or allies. I've heard that a lot in an LGBTQ context, and I don't often hear it in race. And guys, correct me if I'm wrong. And I feel like it's a very different dynamic being an ally in the context of race and in terms of gender or sexuality. And I think that often, especially with race, I think it becomes really uncomfortable somehow. And I think we're just understandably genetically hardwired to support or stand for people who look like us, people who we're comfortable with. And even though we have like a truth and we know what's right, I think it's very easy to just feel uncomfortable and stand up for what's familiar instead of what's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Shazia?
Yeah, that's very true. I've seen it play out in, you know, this dynamic play out in so many other settings too. You know, white fragility and white woman's tears are another example where, you know, maybe a person of color speaks up and another white woman begins crying, and suddenly the person who's spoken up has been, you know, alienated, even though she's taken a big risk in stepping up and speaking up. So, and it's, you know, this has happened. It's even happened to me in like inclusivity conferences, the same dynamic. So it's widespread, and I feel like it's so nuanced that we have to do so much work to even articulate what that even looks like and what's going on.
So it's a strange situation that we find ourselves in, where we have to speak up for ourselves and about our rights, but yet usually we need a non-POC person to do that for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's to me, that just, it's so bizarre. when you talked about white fragility, so there's this poem by Naira Wahid. And she's a Pan-African poet, and she's really like low profile. Like it was really hard for me to find like a strong social media presence for her. And I'm just going to read this, and I'm really curious about what you guys think. And it speaks to white fragility. So this is an excerpt from Salt by Naira Wahid. Here we go. I think one of the most pathological things I have ever seen is stabbing someone and then telling them that their pain and anger over being stabbed is making you sad.
Wow. I'm just going to quit writing right now.
All right. Thank you for tuning in today. How does that make you feel?
That feels like just exactly what we're talking about allyship and about woke people, you know, turning against us. That articulates exactly that, just in like 10 words.
Now, okay, there's a poem that Carol has been dying to read. She's laughing right now. I know you guys can't hear her, but Carol, do you want to take it away? And this is perfect, because we're talking about literature and writing, so this is really perfect.
So this is another excerpt from Naira Wahid's Salt. Our tragedy begins humid, in a humid classroom with a humid textbook, breaking into us, stealing us from ourselves, one poem at a time. It begins with Shakespeare, the hot wash, the cool acid of dead white men and women, people, each one a storm, crashing into our young houses, making us islands, easy isolations, until we are so beleaguered and swollen with the definition of poetry that is white skin and not us, that we tuck our scalding, our soreness behind ourselves and learn poetry. As trauma, as violence, as erasure, another place we do not exist, another form of exile where we should praise, honor our starvation. The little bits of Langston, Phyllis Wheatley, and Angelo during Black History Month are the crumbs, are the minor boats that give a slight rest, to be water-drugged into rejecting the nuances of my own bursting extraordinary self. And to have this be called education, to take my name out of my name, out of where my native poetry lives in me, and replace it with Keats, Browning, Dixon, Wolfe, Joyce, Wilde, Plath, Bronte, Hemingway, Hughes, Bryan, Frost, Cummings, Kipling, Poe, Austin, Whitman, Blake, Longfellow, Wordsworth, Duffy, Twain, Emerson, Yeats, Tennyson, Auden, Thoreau, Chaucer, Thomas, Rabelais, Marlowe, Burns, Shelley, Carroll, Eliot. And so we are here, brown babies, worshiping, feeding the glutton that is white literature, even after it dies.
Oh, so that's a major call out of the entire white canon of poetry.
I know, and I love it. But also, to be fair, I have not read all of these people, but it's just striking how I know all of their names.
Mm.
And like someone coming from an English literature background, the fact that I've never read Kipling is kind of problematic. But also the fact that I
know...
Yeah,
it's pretty impressive, actually.
I know. But also the fact that, like, I know his name without even being able to be like, what did he write? What was his theme? Like, I don't mm-hmm. know anything about him, but mm-hmm. He's so prominent in everything. Mm-hmm. And, like, even, this is not related to English lit, but Greek mythology, I thought that was a common thing that everyone knew. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I came to grad school where I realized... not everyone had this early modern Renaissance, like classical studies education background. And I realized, like, wow, I have like an education background of like a 60-year-old white man. And I identify like my academic.
As a 60-year-old.
I know. I identify like myself in like two academic personas. Like, A, the really lost person of color who just doesn't know anything about the world. And B, a 60-year-old white man who knows everything and almost too much about Renaissance. So there's that. But Lakshmi, you studied philosophy at U of T.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, like, when you heard this poem or when you read it yourself, like, what did you think about in terms of your educational background?
I mean, yeah, like I said, like you said, I did philosophy. And the only time I read anything that was by... you know, a person of color was that one Chinese philosophy course I took in 5 years at U of T. Everything else was just like really old white dudes. Yeah. So this to me was quite...
dead white dudes.
Yeah, dead, of course. Yes. No, I think one was more contemporary. Was he alive? I think. But he was really old, so he might as well have been dead. this speaks to me for sure. And Shazia, there's this... we were talking about this earlier about how when you have like reviews, right? Writing reviews and, mm-hmm. and I mean, how often do you actually see people of color being kind of at the center of this or being kind of highlighted more than, you know, their contrary, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that sort of consciousness has recently come into awareness.
Mm-hmm.
God, that sounds so abstract. Well, but I just feel like...
Well, we were talking about philosophy a second earlier, so...
But, you know, I was part of, I'm still part of the Canadian Women in the Literary Arts, mm-hmm. which is an organization that began in the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did was we started mm-hmm. a count. And we basically counted all the reviews in Canadian magazines and mm-hmm. whether the books reviewed were authored by women and authored by men and who reviewed them, whether they were men or women.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a striking disparity in the statistics that showed up out of that. And lots of books written by men were reviewed by men, and lots of books written by women were rarely reviewed. And since that count has been done a few consecutive years in a row, things have really changed. So there's quite a balance now, and magazines actually do publish their statistics. Some magazines publish their statistics of the gender disparity and how that they're addressing that in the reviews. And I personally try to review writers of color as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more from Shazia, Carol, Danielle, and of course me. So stay tuned to Intersections, and we'll be right back.
That's right. When Super Giant Pizza. Give me pizza!
Been said that people disappoint, but pizza is eternal. That adage is being put to the test with Canadians weighing in on pizza, love, and slice etiquette. 6 in 10 Canadians have some type of relationship deal breaker when it comes to pizza, but 1 in 3 have no pizza love limits at all. The top deal breaker was eating pizza in bed at 18%, and closely behind was anchovies on pizza at 17%. Next up were picks the cheese off at 10%, eats pizza with a knife and fork at 8%, uses too much garlic dipping sauce at 7%, puts pineapple on pizza at 6%, doesn't eat the crust at 6%, and eats it cold at 4%. So cuddle up on the couch and share some za and some love.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITR, more deals than you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses, so come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discord, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Corner's Pub, Australian Boot Company, The Bite Kitchen, Rufus Guitar Shop, Vinyl Records, and the Cinematheque. For more information, visit CITR.ca/friends.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
This band is really good, and I've been wanting to find out more about local music.
Yeah, I heard about it through CITR and Discorder.
What's that?
It's a radio station. You can review all the music that comes in and help out with touring bands or just do some data entry to get started in their music department.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can just email volunteer@citr.ca and they can help you get into the station or just come in whenever.
Well, I'll be there, so...
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM. Thank you for tuning into Intersections. So, yeah, we're here with Shazia, Carol, and Danielle. And Danielle, you have something that you want to read for us?
Yes, I do. This is a poem by Shailaja Patel. She's a Kenyan poet, playwright, and activist. It goes like this. My father speaks Urdu, language of dancing peacocks, rosewater fountains. Even its curses are beautiful. He speaks Hindi, suave and melodic, earthy Punjabi, salty rich as sung paneer, coastal Kiswahili, laced with Arabic. He speaks Gujarati, solid ancestral pride, five languages, five different words, yet English shrinks him down before white men who think their flat, cold, spiky words make the only reality. So, yeah.
Carol, can you please snap into the microphone?
and I think this is really interesting because it ties into the first poem that you read, Lakshmi, about that was from Shazia, about the phrase Khudafiz, which is a really common parting phrase that is used in those parts. So I'm interested
to know. Daniel, do you
use
that in Pakistan?
Yeah, we do. Mm-hmm. Every time you say goodbye, that's actually our way of saying goodbye. So. Mm-hmm. Everybody just, it's either Khudafiz or Alafiz, which are kind of the same things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I want to hear more from you about this, Shazia. What do you think about this poem and how languages play a part in this?
Oh my God, it's so relatable and so beautiful. Just that her, you know, her ability to talk about Urdu and Gujarati and Swahili all in the same sentence. It reflects my upbringing and my life too. Just that code switching, you know, we were talking about, and also just switching between languages, and sometimes I don't even know which language is which. I just know it's a word that's in our house.
Daniel, what does this poem actually mean to you? Because I know there's a personal...
So it speaks to me on a really personal level, I would say, because in my country, in Pakistan, we got independence from the British in, like, 1947, and it's kind of the conversation about, yeah, we got independence, but are we really decolonized? Because English is still considered a symbol of education in my country. Mm-hmm. So I myself, I speak three languages. I speak Urdu, I speak Punjabi, and I speak English. Mm-hmm. But every time I speak English, I can't help but feel that I'm being perceived as more educated, mm-hmm. or as more of a higher standard, mm-hmm. than I would speak in Urdu, mm-hmm. or any other language. And there's a lot of things that play into this, such as, I don't know if you know about this, but fairness creams are a big thing in my country. And just the promise of having a fair complexion, I think that also plays out into how white complexion is the standard of beauty, mm-hmm. just as English is the standard of being educated. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's kind of the conversation that's really interesting, and that speaks to me as well. Like, are we really decolonized, mm-hmm. or are we still colonized in some way? Mm-hmm. It's like,
yeah, those are all remnants of colonization, right?
Yeah, like it's
the fairness.
Yeah, I think the term is cultural imperialism, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for this kind of phenomena. That's the proper term for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so yeah, it speaks to me on a lot of levels, on a personal level as well. And mm-hmm. yeah, and also when I've been in Canada for 3 months, mm-hmm. and half of the people that I talk to, the most common question I get asked is, why is your English so good? Mm-hmm. Why do you have an accent? So yeah, that's mm-hmm. also really mm-hmm. strange to mm-hmm. me. I'm like, why is that even a question? Why are you so surprised? Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to sound differently?
Am I supposed to sound like Apu?
Yeah, am mm-hmm. I supposed to sound like Apu from The Simpsons or some other mm-hmm. mainstream Indian character that you see on TV? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it speaks to me on a lot of levels.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that before, that why is your English so good? Mm-hmm. Or like, oh, you sound native, like it's a compliment. that's definitely, it's very strange to me. With this poem, I think the reason I could connect to it is because she specifically mentions, like, oh, my father shrinks down. And that's something, mm-hmm. like, that's something I've seen in my own dad. Like, he speaks, I think, like, four languages. And he's just, in terms of languages, he's just so accomplished. And it's, even as a human being, he's accomplished so much. But when he comes here, it's somehow, I just feel like he shrinks. When it comes to English, it's like the full force of his personality as a human being and his, like, rich ancestral, like, identity and his history just doesn't translate through this, in his words, a rigid language. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's so sad, too. Like, I still go eat fish and chips every Sunday, you know, my family in Cockney Kings, which is, like, this British-Canadian mm-hmm. place to eat fish and chips. And we'll go there, and then my dad will complain about the Brits when we get home. So it's this, you know, really
the irony.
Mixed feeling, you know.
That's a good point, though, like, Lakshmi, your point about how you, like, see your dad kind of struggle with the fact that he can speak so many languages, but English is kind of this, I guess, like, cage that kind of defines him as lesser than, simply mm-hmm. because it is such a global language. And it brought me back to when I was younger. My dad, he has a PhD.
Damn.
I know, just as like a promo. He's like very intelligent. He's published many books, blah, 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 blah. But he has an accent. And he's noticed in his own life, if he doesn't wear a suit and he doesn't carry a briefcase, people are very confused by the fact that he can speak English, even though he has a slight accent. Mm-hmm. And whenever he's just kind of casually conversing with people, and it's like, oh, yeah, like, I have a PhD. And they're like, what?
Wow.
You? And at first he was like, oh, like, that was a compliment. And I was like, Dad, no, like, they were shocked. That's not a compliment. Mm-hmm. Like, they were confused by your educational background and the fact that you have translated so many books in English and in Korean. Mm-hmm. So really, when you think about it, like, they're actually, like, making a dig at you. And he was like, oh, really? I was like, yeah. Like, you are literally being reduced to what the colonizers have wanted us to become. Mm-hmm. And it's still something that I'm struggling with, where I went to Korea this past summer, and I don't speak Korean very well, which is really, really upsetting, but it's fine. I'm working through it. And me speaking English, like, I got so much praise. And everyone was like, oh, my gosh, like, you are this amazing goddess, and you can speak English, and you can read all these things. And I was like, well, it's not that fascinating, but
it was weird because I was getting so much praise and I was like, why? Like, I just speak one extra language and it's like a stupid language. Like, let's be honest, English is not the best language to use in any setting. And it is, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's just, like, it's such a hard language to learn. We have so many slang.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's like a jump. Like, I don't understand how people even learn English because it's like an evolving language. Mm-hmm. It's literally alive.
Mm-hmm.
Half the time, I don't even know if I'm making sense to people because my slang doesn't match up with Vancouver slang.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah. What is language?
No, but I mean, I feel that for sure. And what I said earlier about English being rigid, I just feel like, I mean, I speak two other languages. I just feel like there's so many beautiful phrases and words that exist in other languages and just like states of being, really, that just, it just flat out doesn't exist in English. Like, there's no translation. And I feel like a lot of times when I'm trying to translate something from, I don't know, Sanskrit or Telugu or Hindi, it just sounds so like, just so like bland, like mm-hmm. when you translate it back into English. So in that sense, I think English is, yeah, it's quite rigid in addition to being, you know, obviously it's constantly evolving.
It's a dumb language.
Oh boy. We're not endorsing that. CITR is not endorsing that comment.
I'm going to stop for Carol here.
Right.
Daniel. I speak English mm-hmm. only. So.
No, I mean, so do I. It's ironic, but like, it's just still, you know.
Yeah,
but that's really interesting, though, because I feel that, too, you know, and I feel like part of the process of decolonization for me is mm-hmm. just trying to learn these languages that I've lived in with my family, and to try to recover those stories and try to recover everything mm-hmm. just through living in the language.
Mm-hmm. So Shazia, do you feel like the fact that, and I'm sure you're still, there's no, like, you're not entirely unaware of the languages, right? You know mm-hmm. a few words from the languages.
I understand.
Yeah. So do you feel like when you're trying to, in kind of describing your identity and like your ancestral identity, do you feel like not knowing the language somehow is like a barrier to fully understanding your past?
Yes, I definitely feel that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I've been trying to speak back with my parents, you know, trying to engage in conversation, trying to respond in Swahili or mm-hmm. in Urdu or in Hindi or in Farsi, mm-hmm. just to speak back, to put myself back into the language. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it's really rough because, you know, there's that, it's that Oreo effect. So because you feel light on the inside.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Right?
Girl, say that again.
The coconut effect. Did you want to say something, Daniel? All right. Okay. We have to talk about Lena Dunham. Okay. And this is, by the way, guys, this is going back to the whole, sorry, guys, we thought our microphones just cut off, so we had a little moment of panic. We're talking about, you know, being allyship, what it's like being a good ally and a bad ally. And I feel like Lena is a very controversial figure right now. And I'm curious about what you guys think. Because she represents a certain brand of feminism. I'm not going to go into that further. What do you guys think?
Well, so I have a complicated relationship with Lena Dunham because I loved her show Girls.
Mm-hmm.
I lived by it. I was like, oh my gosh, it's like a feminist show. Huh, I love it. But she herself has branded herself as a white feminist, which I admit I was also a white feminist growing up because that's all I knew. But Lena Dunham, like, she is like the icon or symbol of white feminism, but also how women are tools for the patriarchy. And in her apology, or no, it was she tweeted out, I believe in a lot of things, but the first tenet of my politics is to hold up the people who have held me up, who have filled my world with love. And if that doesn't scream patriarchy, I don't know what does. Because it's true, intersectional feminism is something that we're still kind of trying to work around and understand and practice. But Lena Dunham really portrayed how white women can really, I guess, use people, women of color, to sacrifice and for their own survival techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, that whole controversy really showed how women of color are never believed. And that kind of really made me realize we really need woke white feminists who are not white feminists.
Right.
So I'm just curious, Shazia, like, what do you, have you ever had maybe an experience where you've kind of dealt with a Lena Dunham-like person or experiences that are similar to that?
Shazia, before I let you answer that question, explain the controversy for those who, or like, our listeners who haven't heard about it.
So one of her writers and friend, what was his name? Murray Miller. He basically was accused for sexually assaulting an actress, Aurora, I can never pronounce her name, but P. And she was assaulted when she was about 17 years old. And when this allegation occurred, Lena Dunham just quickly defended him and said, you know, this is one of those cases where women lie about being sexually assaulted. And she didn't believe her friend, and Aurora was her friend and colleague. And she just put out the statement like, you know, I love him as a brother. I know who he is. He would never do such a thing. And it was just your classic woman, white women just picking up patriarchal sentiments. But yeah.
Yeah. And again, that dynamic is so common, you know, where people will stand up, like white women will stand up for the people in power who have supported them. You know, that statement about her politics is like clearly just nepotism, that you support people who have supported you. And that's the sole reason, you know, just to bring up her own status or whatever else she wants to promote for herself. I think that's exactly what allyship might look like, to support people who have been with you in the past, but it's exactly what it isn't. But it will often, that's what it gets mistaken for being. Yeah.
All right. Okay. We're going to take another short break and we'll be right back. Stay tuned to Intersections. We'll be right back after the super duper short break.
Excuse me. Hi. I was wondering how I maybe might potentially get to be on the radio.
Oh, word. Yeah. You can do that at CITR and Discorder.
I'm sorry?
You can cover events and issues in the city and interview people, or you could join a collective and work with people with similar interests to make a show collaboratively, maybe make a few friends.
Oh, wow, that sounds superb.
Totally. Just email volunteer@citr.ca and they can help you get started or just come into the station whenever.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you so much.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITR with deals and you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses. So come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discorder, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Devil Mayware, Audiopile, the Stormcrow Tavern and Ale House, the Biltmore, Book Warehouse, and Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium. For more information, visit citr.ca/friends.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism, as opposed to someone who buys, like you know, all their clothes. Let's say, you know, someone buys their clothes.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
Hi, and welcome back to CITR at 101.9 FM. You're listening to Intersections, and I'm Carol, and I have another poem that I really wanted to share with you guys. It's called Decolonization by Naira Wahid. When you tell yourself, you can have your energy back after years of giving it to white people and their requirements for acceptance, for supple colonization, digesting their beliefs, thoughts, opinions of you, when you remove them from your nucleus, your being is then allowed to focus its power on turning your life into your soul's work. You become yours again. That was great. So Shazia, as a poet, how does this poem make you feel?
Oh, it makes me feel relieved, like I'm never going to have to do any self-care again.
What do you mean by that?
I just feel like it addresses so much of the energy and the work that goes into creating conversations about into creating decolonization, you know, decolonizing spaces and decolonizing our lives, what that means, and the energy that goes into that.
I mean, and I really like this bit that Nara Wahid, she says, supple colonization. And I think it's a very tricky subject, colonization, right? Because I think it's woven itself so intricately into our, you know, the daily kind of cloth of our lives that it's quite hard to see where you kind of start and where this pattern starts. So yeah, how do we decolonize daily spaces? What does that even look like?
I think we're still trying to figure that out ourselves right now. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a defining solution yet, but in terms of maybe the classroom setting, because that itself is a symbol of colonization, in my opinion, and imperialism.
Wait, you have to explain that.
Well, I mean, the classroom, if we kind of use that as a metaphor for the Western education system, it's the entire system, and you can disagree with me, but it was built to purposely keep people like ourselves, people of color, out. Like, we weren't meant to have this prestigious education. It was for people of class, money, who are white.
Predominantly male.
Yes, male. So the classroom, I can already feel like every time I walk in and I sit down, I purposely sit at the back. Because I know that's where I'm most safe and it's closest to the door. And that might sound really dramatic, but I just know that my voice is never that important compared to my peers. And that might hurt the feelings of my professors. But as a woman and as a person of color, I have different lived experiences from my white counterparts. And it's just this space where I just feel like I'm not good enough. And I feel like that's kind of the dictum for Western education. You're just never good enough. You get a master's, you're still not good enough. You get a PhD, you're still not good enough. You are an award-winning poet and author, still not good enough.
Yeah,
and it's this vicious cycle where you're just made to feel like you're never good enough. And I'm not saying that, you know, white people or white students don't feel this way, but it's particularly a running theme for people of color. And I don't know if you agree with that or...
Yeah, I completely relate to that. I feel like even the inadequacies internalized, especially because, you know, I'm from an immigrant family, and so that work ethic, you know, like work hard and don't complain is also part of that inadequacy. But it's also, you're being at a school like UBC and, you know, being elsewhere too in other schools, as you were saying, the Western education system, it really does need to be decolonized because, you know, I haven't seen voices like my own. This is the first time I'm reading a poem like Shailja Patel or Naira Wahid. So it's great that it's happening now, but it's also sad that it hasn't happened before, you know, and that we've had to make that space to do it.
And speaking of internalizing your inadequacies, I think in my personal experience, I feel like the first time I realized that I was actually internalizing this weird idea of like, you know, colonialism or just kind of the remnants of colonialism was I realized that I have a different persona for when I'm interacting with people of color and when I'm interacting with white people.
And that's what I call the white person mask.
I didn't coin this, but
it's
yeah,
coined.
It was
coined
now, but TM, I mean, TM. I can't take credit because Collins came up with it. But anyway,
okay, shout out to Collins.
when we were talking, Collins, me and Rumnik and I, we were talking about how we noticed individually that we have a literal mask that we wear when we are in white spaces. So like in classrooms and conferences, just wherever. And for me, I present myself as a very reserved, quiet person. And my accent literally changes. And this is my white person voice that I'm speaking in right now, because this is also a very white space. Not literally, but
I mean, the walls are kind of white, I guess.
So. I mean, everything is. Anyway, and for Collins, I mean, I don't want to speak his own truth, but he also tones himself down. He becomes more elegant, quote unquote. And for Rumnik, she kind of portrays herself as this put together, posh lady who does not swear, does not have, you know, loud expressions or anything like that. And we were talking about this and we had this moment of realization. We're like, wow, we all do this. And this isn't just a unique experience for each person. Like, most people of color do this without realizing that they are doing this. And that's what you call the white person mask, because it's more put together, which even that phrase is problematic. But
Right. And Danielle, tell me if this is something that you can, both of you, really. When I say both, I mean Shazia and you, Danielle, if this is something that you can relate to. I mean, in terms of actually kind of toning yourself down, I wonder if that's something that I experience. I'm not sure, but for sure with the way I speak, the words I use, and just like my accent entirely changes. Like if you guys heard me talking to my parents, you'd be like, who is this person? Like I sound like, and I'm so sorry to say this, but I sound like fresh off the boat. Like I'm as Indian as Indian can be. And obviously this is not what I sound like. And it's not even, I can't even say it's intentional. It's just, it's almost like a survival mechanism. Like this is how I have to talk and be in order to just seem like I am one of, you know, one of you guys, whatever, whoever you guys is. And Danielle, is this something that you can relate to?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the way I'm speaking right now, I would, to quote Carol, this is more like a white person mask that I'm putting on just to, I would say, fit in or survive, as you put it. But yeah, I can definitely assure you this is not how I speak with my friends or with my family. So I have a really interesting thing that happened to me a couple of weeks ago where I was talking to a couple of friends. I was just playing a computer game and we were just chatting and I was talking in my own language. And we code switch a lot in our language, so we will talk in Urdu and then use some words in English, and that's just kind of how we speak generally. So I was just doing that, and my roommate just knocks on the door, and he walks in, and I immediately switch to how I'm speaking right now. And I didn't even realize what happened, but my friends did. And they immediately like, what just happened?
Who are you?
I'm like, what just happened? And you completely changed the way you were speaking. You started talking in an accent. And I'm like, oh, did I? I didn't realize it. But yeah, so that was kind of a self-realizing moment for me of how quickly I can just switch gears between this and just to communicate or just fit into a place that isn't my home.
Yeah. So and I feel like with accent switching, it might seem, for people who are unaware that people of color have this secret ability to switch accents and codes, I mean, it might sound simple, right? You just sound a little different. But I think there's just so much behind sounding a certain way. Like even myself, like I hate to admit it, but I automatically you make these assumptions about a person just based on how they sound. You know, you make assumptions, whether you know it or not, about their, you know, how smart, you know, you think they are, and like how educated, how, you know, literate or whatever it is, like just by the way they sound, even if their English is like crystalline, perfect, just by the way, you know, their accent is. And I'm curious, like, especially in the world of like, you know, like poetry readings and stuff like that, like, do you think, does that make a difference just the way a poet or a writer sounds when they talk?
I'm relating so hard right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like especially, I'm constantly aware of this, especially when I go out to like writer parties or like conferences or anything. I always make sure I'm like calm and I can speak clearly and I've slept the night before. Yeah. So I'm not like scatterbrained and my thoughts aren't just leaking out.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm also especially aware of it because I know that people know, mm-hmm. especially since my books come out, that I'm a recovered addict, mm-hmm. and I've also experienced clinical depression, and I know people can be discriminated mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. that too. So I feel like I've, you know, I'm consciously aware of how I'm speaking and making sure that yeah. there's no opportunity for anyone to say, oh yeah, but she's depressed, you know,
right,
or
right.
like she's an addict, so that's right. why she messed up.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and speaking of, and this was something, it was actually Tanya's poem, A Eulogy, which I do not have up right now, but there's a bit in there where she talks about, you know, about people of color being passed over in favor of someone with an easier name and, you know, easier name to pronounce. And I think that that, along with, you know, sounding a certain way, I think that you can actually, you can block a lot of opportunities for yourself just by having a certain name or by just sounding a certain way. Like, I think there are several opportunities in my own life, and tell me what you guys think, where I feel like I only got that position, or, you know, I got that, whatever it is, just because I sound a certain way or I present myself a certain way. Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever feel that?
So I think this might kind of relate to this, but so I've been in Canada for 3 months, and before coming here, my really close family friend, they were over to our place, and one of the points that they brought up was that they kind of complimented my dad on mm-hmm. choosing a name that is easier to pronounce by white people for me, so Danielle, mm-hmm. instead of a name that might be something like Muhammad or Ali or Ahmed or something like this. And I didn't get it then, mm-hmm. but now I kind of do feel that, and they themselves said that their son's name was can't remember, but it was Muhammad Shahrukh or something mm-hmm. like that, and they talked about how he always had problems with people pronunciations of his name, mm-hmm. and also just how a name can trigger a lot of presumptions about a certain person. So yeah, I think that kind of plays into how having a more easy name.
Yeah, when I show people my name, especially at the library or something, they'll say, oh, it's just said exactly how it's written. And then they're suddenly happier about mm-hmm. it. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
I guess because Shazia is like very similar to other anglicized names or yeah. English names like Nadia or like yeah. Razia, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So, mm-hmm. so I guess, like, I mean, what is... I feel like we've touched on so many different topics here. I mean, these kind of conversations are not something that you can just kind of... It's intersectional, you know. There's so many different facets to any kind of conversation about race. But I mean, to me, the takeaway was that we can't decolonize daily spaces if we become part of that system. If we're enabling the process of colonization by, you know, presenting to choose ourselves in a way that we deem more acceptable. So is the takeaway that the only way to decolonize spaces is to A, have these conversations that we're doing right now, and B, just express the full force of our personality, including our identities, our cultural and, you know, historical identities, and hope that that will be enough to kind of wear down this system of oppression.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the finding, you know, as for me, it's not even a matter of wearing down so much or trying to break it down. It's mm-hmm. a matter of finding my way out. Yeah, and to yeah. me, that's just like finding my people and finding mm-hmm. my people through the language and through the culture and trying to recover those things for myself and seeing how I fit in the world newly mm-hmm. and find a sense of belonging.
Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, we're at the end of our show, unfortunately. Is there anything that you guys want to say before we say goodbye to our listeners? Any
this was
parting
so
thoughts?
Nice. I wish we could just hang out forever.
Anything for you, Carol and Daniel? Anything in last parting words? All right. Okay. Snap. Speak more than words. I don't know. Okay. All right, Shazia. Thank you so much for being here, and a gigantic thanks to everyone who tuned into today's show. Be kind to one another, everyone. Happy holidays, and see y'all on the flip side. Although
thank
we'll
you,
see you
Danielle
back,
and yeah. Carol.
We'll see you guys in Jan. This is not the Last of Us you're gonna see. All right, take care, everyone. This is Lakshmi, Carol, Danielle, and Shazia signing off for now.
Bye.
Bye.